Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, a family meeting about sleep. This is part of the kickoff of a WNYC April Sleep Project. Later we'll tell you how to take part in our community data experiment called Clock Your Sleep. Good morning, everyone. Let's get this going with some of your calls. And the first question is simply, what keeps you up at night and how do you fight it? 212-433-WNYC. Let's get some stories on the air as kind of a baseline here to start out. If you have trouble sleeping, what keeps you up at night? And what, if anything, brings on the Z's? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You can help others by calling in and telling your story, even if it doesn't have a clear solution. If you have trouble sleeping, what keeps you up at night? And what, if anything, brings on the Z's as we begin our family meeting on sleep? 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. Call in now. Are there specific things in your life you can't stop thinking about? Is that your issue? 212-433-WNYC. And are you just too wound up sometimes from all the demands of your day-to-day life and you can't decelerate from 60 to zero just like that? Are you trying to do chore, 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 sleep, but it ain't that easy? 212-433-9692. And maybe you get to sleep easily enough, but you wake up way too early. Does that sound like you? Or have you just started popping awake in the middle of the night as you get older and can't get back to sleep and don't even know why? Even though you can get to sleep okay at the beginning of the night, 212-433-WNYC. At what age did you start having trouble with sleep, if this is something that has come on you over time? And if you have trouble sleeping, call in and tell us. What keeps you up at night? And what, if anything, brings on the Z's? 212-433-9692. And we'll start with Jimmy in Bayville. Jimmy, thanks for calling and starting us off. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay. Did you sleep last night?
I have many sleepless nights, and I have a habit, and I don't know why I do this, but my brain has become wired to, as soon as I have enough consciousness, that it goes to things I worry about, points of stress. I'm a small business owner, and there's a lot of stress in it, and I try and fight it, but usually I toss and turn and just give in and go make a pot of coffee.
And this is one of the things that we'll talk about when we bring on some guests in a few minutes, is how do we get our minds off those stress points? Because I think your story is so common, Jimmy. People who are worrying about their business, people who are worrying about their family, things like that. And we go right there in the middle of the night so often, instead of going to what movie you just saw that you really liked. Wasn't that final episode of How I Met Your Mother really great?
It's amazing. And I try and fight it. And I never used to be like that. I used to sleep like a log. My wife used to get mad at me because the kids would be crying, and I would not wake up. And now I'm up three times a night, and she gets mad at me because I get up.
What does work for you when it works? Anything?
What does work for me? Exhaustion.
Uh-huh.
So, exhaustion, really. I try and fight it. I've read things. Write it down. Write down your worries on a pad by your nightstand. Think of good thoughts. Sometimes I find that maybe I'll be able to go back to sleep, but majority of the time I find myself just over worrying and just stress points that. And I get mad at myself because it's an amazing thing that trigger happens as soon as my consciousness is aware of the fact that I'm awake, and boom, it's like a vacuum straight to that point.
Right, and that awareness that you're awake doesn't help. It's the try to relax paradox. Oh, I'm aware that I'm awake. I'm aware that I'm not sleeping. I'm aware that I have to try to sleep. And then you try to sleep, and then you're trying not to try. And a lot of people get stuck there. Jimmy, thanks for starting us off. I really appreciate it. I'm sure a lot of people relate to exactly the way you described your situation. Exhaustion is an interesting element here because for some people, yeah, you are sleepless for a few nights, and then you're so tired, you just sleep. You'd think that would be the natural cycle, but it doesn't work that way. Usually for Jimmy, it sounds like, and it doesn't work that way for a lot of people. So when we get some guests coming on in a little while, we'll put all of that out there. 212-433-WNYC. If you have trouble sleeping, what keeps you up at night and what, if anything, brings on the Z's? Britta in Hell's Kitchen, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Britta.
Good morning. Good morning.
Did you sleep last night?
Actually, I slept better than I had been sleeping. I was up for about an hour, but I usually wake up because I have so much on my mind that, you know, I'm a creative person and I'm either writing something or working on a deadline. And so last night, yesterday morning, I finished the deadline, so I knew I could sleep if I was able to. But I woke up between 2 and 3:30. And at that point, I knew I could tell myself to relax, but I wasn't able to go back to sleep. So I got up and had some warm milk and just read, you know, The New Yorker or something. And then I was able to go back to sleep, and I actually slept in until, like, 5 after 6.
Five after six? That's sleeping in?
Yeah. When I can get a full night, I usually am up at 4 or 5, and that is typically good. I tend to go to sleep pretty early, 9 p.m. But when I'm, you know, really fully into something, it's just my ideas that wake me up. And usually I have something important to write down, so I'll just get up and work for a while.
And am I right listening to you that, unlike Jimmy, it's not always what's stressing you out? It's sometimes your own euphoria, is that too strong a word, over the ideas that you're having for your creative work?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, it has stressed me out. I think I got into this habit when I was in graduate school and teaching a freshman writing class that I wasn't actually that prepared for. So I'd get up and really, you know, jam on the preparations and then try to get some sleep before I had to go to class.
Right. And you know what a lot of creative people do is keep a pad by the side of the bed. If you have an idea, write it down, so you can then put it on that little paper bubble and dismiss it.
Yeah, but then I still can't get back to sleep. So yeah. I've found over the years that it's just easier to get up and do some work for an hour or two and then go back to sleep.
Right. You talked about reading The New Yorker last night. Does reading work for you a lot? And are there certain things to read or not to read in your case?
Yeah, I have to read something completely different than something I'm working on because my mental energy just gets too wound up.
That makes sense. And not too something not too interesting, or does that matter?
Just it can't be on the electronic device. It has to be in paper form because I know that that's going to affect my eyeballs, that blue light. You know,
right.
I've read that. So
yeah. And
that
we'll talk about we'll talk about the science of the blue light with our guest coming up. Britta, thank you very much. Good luck out there. Maybe we'll get you some answers. Ilya in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Ilya.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How'd you sleep last night?
Last night was pretty average. I go to sleep somewhere after midnight and wake up in time to get kids to school. I only woke up once or twice yesterday, though. That was good. But I am my own worst sleep enemy. That's my confession of the day, if I'm going to be real. So I can't help but waking up in the middle of the night and what my mind does, and I won't repeat what other listeners have said. I agree that reading in paper is great, but I need to get myself in bed earlier. There's always one more thing to do, and I am worse than my children when it comes to procrastinating about just getting into bed.
How many hours do you think you need to feel good when you wake up?
I haven't slept more than 6 or 7 hours in probably over a decade, maybe once or twice. So I don't know, but they say 8 hours. I'd like to try that at some point. But there's so much to do and enjoy and experience and read that
You want to live. You don't want to sleep.
For me, it's more often that than it is stress, although, of course, that plays a role as well. I saw something on, I think it was House of Cards. There was this great quote where it was a quote that was about, you know, man's weakness is that we actually have to lie down at some point. And that's frustrating for me.
Absolutely. For me, too. We'll talk about that with our next guest, too. But when you get the 6 or 7 hours of sleep that you get, it sounds from what you're saying that you don't actually feel too bad because there's just so much you want to do. So do you have negative repercussions from not getting as much sleep as you might want?
Yeah, if I'm under like 6.5 hours, my memory suffers terribly, and it's my short-term memory. I've been known to like store pens in the refrigerator and not know where I put them and things like that. I can't seem to hold onto thoughts, which is obviously challenging at work. I'd say my short-term memory and then also my workouts, which are important to me and my performance elsewhere, they suffer obviously if I haven't had enough sleep. And I think it goes on and on. I definitely need more sleep.
Ilya, good luck tonight, every night, during the day. Thank you for calling us. Karen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. Sleep last night?
I slept okay. I slept, I usually go to bed pretty late. I go to bed after my husband does because I work from home. I can't go to sleep without Ambien. I used to take the other kind of sleep remedy, not the Tylenol PM, but the other one. If I don't take it, I don't sleep, and I feel it because my PTSD kicks in a little bit at night if I'm trying to go to sleep and I can't fall asleep. I'll just have flashbacks of stuff that happened to me in high school and junior high, and even though it was a long time ago, mm-hmm. I'll just kind of relive certain memories, mm-hmm. and it'll just happen. Forget about stress or whatever that's going on during now. It just kind of comes in. And I'm sure like other guests have said or will say, you know, people just tell you to just push those memories away. It's very hard. Something you can't really just do. And to me, Ambien, it just kind of helps you sleep. And to me, it is kind of medication in a sense for PTSD. And I guess I would tell people Ambien works so well that, I mean, if you haven't taken it yet, you shouldn't because you'll want to use it a lot. But I kind of have a love-hate relationship with Ambien because if I don't take it, I don't sleep.
What's the hate part if it works for you?
Well, the hate part is that I have to take it.
Oh, did we lose you?
No, I'm right here.
Go ahead, Karen.
Well, the hate part is that I have to take that if I don't take it, I don't sleep.
Uh-huh. So it's not particular side effects or even worry about long-term side effects. It's just that psychological letting yourself down by being dependent on an external substance?
I don't really know too much about the long-term side effects. I know it's a fairly new drug. My doctor's given it to me. He knows how much I take. I've never raised my dosage in the few years that I've taken it, and he's never batted an eyelash about it. I don't know a lot about the long-term side effects. I know there's a difference between addiction and dependency, and Ambien is dependency.
You don't like that you need it.
Yeah, but I mean, it works. So I take it because it works, and it helps with, you know, it helps you sleep if you're being kept up at night because of bad, stressful thoughts.
Right.
It helps you go to sleep.
Karen, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much. And we're going to ask a doctor who's coming on in a little while about Ambien and other sleep medications. Are there long-term dangers that either have or have not been studied but need to be studied because they haven't been ruled out? Or why not take medication if, like Karen, it helps you sleep on a regular basis? Sarah in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Did you sleep last night?
Well, I wanted to talk about, I have chronic daily migraines, and they started around the same time as my insomnia. My insomnia mostly manifests in like the 4 a.m. to 6 a.m. wake up time.
Uh-huh.
And during trying to figure out, you know, going to lots of doctors and trying to work on my migraine stuff, I tried this vitamin called phosphatidylserine, and it is supposed to be a cortisol regulator, and it's really helped quite a bit, and so I wanted to call in and kind of share that. Because I guess supposedly...
So it's a supplement that you can buy over the counter at a health food store or a drugstore?
Yeah, exactly. It's supposed to be, it's just like, I mean, it's silly, but it's for brain health. That's what it says, you know, on the bottle or whatever.
But you're finding it helps you sleep, so whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So, supposedly there's a cortisol spike around 4 a.m. and around 11 a.m., and that is sometimes what jolts people awake around that time at night.
Phosphatidyl.
And so it's supposed to... Yeah, I can
say it again. Say the whole name of it, just in case people.
Phosphatidylserine, phosphatidyl, and then serine, serine.
Sarah, thank you very much. And when our first guest comes on in just a few minutes to talk about the science of sleep, we'll ask about that. 4 a.m. and 11 a.m. spike, is that really true? Is there such a thing as a biological clock that's independent of us as human beings or our activities or when we work? Anthony in Clifton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I heard your guest yesterday talking, and it described me exactly about how I don't have a problem getting this, you know, going to sleep initially, but I wake up in the middle of the night, as probably most men my age do, and go to the bathroom, and then it's, boom, the switch is on and my brain starts going, and to get back to sleep is real difficult. And, you know, the thing is, if I don't fall asleep and get like another 45 minutes to a half hour, I'm wrecked, like today.
You'd wreck right now because you couldn't get back to sleep last night.
Yeah, I didn't get that last, I mean, I'm not sleeping a full 8 hours, but sometimes if I can just get that last cycle out properly and get a last, you know, rest where I wake up on my own, even if it's a half hour, I feel refreshed. But yeah, you know, as I was telling your producer, I used to sleep a lot better before I had kids and a mortgage. You know, I'm up at the littlest sound in the house.
Because you're thinking about the house and you're thinking about the kids and you just have more on your mind than when you were young and single.
I think so. I think things used to be a lot simpler and you used to have a restful sleep. But I just wanted to tell a quick story. I remember when I was about 12 years old and I went to my neighbor, I was over at my neighbor's house and his father was always sleeping. He had a lazy boy and in the middle of the day he'd be sleeping. And I asked him one time either him or my friend, and he was like, yeah, my dad only sleeps 5 hours a night. And I was like horrified by that. And now as someone who's that age or nearing that age, I'm doing the exact same thing. I think, you know, it's just amazing how you just fall right into the pattern based on all the, as life changes.
What works for you when it does work? Anything in particular or just trying to avoid getting your brain engaged when you wake up to go to the bathroom?
I'm trying to, you know, I stay in bed. I don't want to get up and fight it and play that game. I stay in bed and I just keep trying to clear my mind and just work on clearing my mind. And eventually, sometimes it takes a half hour, sometimes it takes an hour and a half. Hopefully it eventually works. And most times it does. But it's definitely not going to bed and sleeping through the night and getting 7 hours or 8 hours like it used to be.
Anthony, thank you for your call. Carolita writes on our webpage, if I think about anything with numbers, dates, deadlines, money, debt, computer problems at night, I will not sleep. So those subjects are totally forbidden when speaking to me anytime when I'm winding down to go to bed. If I get to bed and find I have a little trouble falling asleep, the thing that works every time, and she puts every time in caps, try to imagine the outfit I'm going to wear in the morning. Carolita writes, the most boring thought ever, since I pretty much wear the same thing to work every day. So it works. I always fall asleep before I decide on the whole outfit. So there's a little baseline, folks. What helps? What helps you sleep? And if you have trouble sleeping, what keeps you up at night? Before you find that solution to bring on the Z's or not, let's bring on some guests and talk more about it. Thank you. It's our family meeting on sleep on the Brian Lehrer Show. We're talking about sleep all morning today as part of WNYC's Clock Your Sleep Project. Go to WNYC.org to start keeping a sleep journal with the rest of us. And we just heard that lots of people struggle with sleep. Now let's get into some of the science of this. What is sleep anyway? Why does it matter for quality of life or long-term health? What scientifically impedes sleep? Joining us for this is Dr. Carl Bazile, Director of the Division of Epilepsy and Sleep at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. He's been advising WNYC on our new Clock Your Sleep project. Welcome back to WNYC, Dr. Bazile.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And listeners, ask a sleep scientist. The phones are open, so we're going to clear the lines of people calling for the previous segment with just what keeps you up. Ask a sleep scientist anything about how sleep and sleeplessness work. 212-433-WNYC. So what is sleep anyway? Because honestly, Dr. Bazile, I get angry at having to sleep. If you sleep well, you're giving up a third of your life to not doing anything. And honestly, I'd rather not have to sleep, or rather not have to choose between sleeping and feeling like hell if I don't sleep. So what is sleep really?
Well, there's no simple answer to that, but it is something that your body needs for lots of reasons, and I'm sure we'll get into that. It seems like a waste of time because we can overcome it, and that's what I've heard from a lot of the people that call in. That's a natural thing. In fact, it's a protective thing that your body can overcome that need to sleep if it really needs to. The problem is it sometimes does that when it doesn't really need to.
Is there a difference between sleep and being unconscious, or sleep and being in a coma, or sleep and being under general anesthesia?
There absolutely is. Your brain, when you're asleep, is actually very active, and this is one of the big areas of research in sleep medicine. We're trying to understand what exactly is happening in that very active brain. Whereas if you look at someone who is anesthetized, their brain patterns are very, very different, so it's definitely not the same thing.
Different how? Do you know?
Well, there are structures that we see in the electrophysiology of the brain during sleep that are very stereotyped. Now, we don't know what a lot of them mean, but there are lots of different frequencies, lots of buzzes activity that we see in different stages of sleep. If someone is deeply anesthetized, there's very little activity going on.
I think people want to know, how much sleep am I supposed to get? So what's the answer? And is that even the right question?
Well, it's not a simple thing to answer, but the ballpark figure that most people believe is correct is between 7 and 8 hours for an adult. It varies somewhat according to age. It doesn't really drop as you get older, but one of the more concerning areas is teenagers who actually need more than that, and they're probably a group that is getting, if anything, less than the adults right now.
How do you know you're not getting enough sleep? Is it just the obvious answer, you feel tired?
Well, that's your first signal. If you are falling asleep very easily, especially in places where you shouldn't, like if you sit down for a moment and start to read, you immediately fall asleep, that's a signal. If you're very, very sleep deprived, you may even fall asleep doing things like talking to somebody, or most frighteningly, while you're driving, if you're stopped at a light, or even if you're on a long, boring stretch of highway. Now, that's really terrifying, but that's the kind of signal that your body is telling you you're not getting enough sleep.
Your calls for Dr. Carl Bazile on the science of sleep, 212-433-WNYC. And Ina in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Dina.
Dina, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I have a question about sleep talking. My husband is a sleep talker. It started about 2 or 3 years ago, and it really affects my sleep. And even using a sleep tracker, I noticed that I sleep pretty well until the time he comes to bed, and then I'm up periodically during the night with his sleep talking. And then on the nights that he's not talking, I find that I'm waking up anyway in the middle of the night around those same times. And I'm kind of wondering if I'm also being trained to wake up in the middle of the night when there's not the interruption.
I think that's probably true. Obviously, sleep talking isn't really a problem for him. It's
right.
Not common in adults. It's very common in children. But what's happening to you is it's becoming a signal that wakes you up, and that's obvious. You hear something, it's your husband, and your brain can wake you up from that. But like many triggers for potential insomnia, that can become ingrained. So how you get over it, now that's a more complicated question. It also depends on how much of a problem it is. It sounds like it is becoming a problem for you, though.
It can be up to 5 nights a week.
Now, do you have trouble, like, you hear him and you wake up and you stay awake, or is it just that you feel like your sleep is very disturbed?
I feel like my sleep is very disturbed. I do wake up from it. Often I can fall back to sleep. Sometimes I can't, depending on what time of the night it is. But often I am able to fall back to sleep. But I find that it'll happen multiple times during the night, and I just feel interrupted.
Sure. Well, one of the things I like to start with in that sort of scenario is to recommend relaxation techniques, and that may sound very simplistic. It may not be enough, but things that you can do before you go to sleep that are variations on meditation or even self-hypnosis that might help you to get past that. I mean, there are other treatments. I wouldn't want to jump to medicine for something like that, but, you know, behavioral treatments can often help.
Thank you, Ina. Good luck. Are we worse at sleeping in New York City, you know, the city that never sleeps? Is sleep cultural?
I think it absolutely is, and there's lots of evidence of that. In New York, you know, what one of the things that we keep alluding to is your body will respond to stimulus. Well, a place like New York that literally doesn't sleep, there's things going on all night, things that you may want to do, going out to clubs, some people are into that, working late at night, that's very prevalent here. But there's also, you know, noise stimulus. There's ambulances, there's, you know, noisy neighbors. There's lots of things that wake us up more here than if we were living on a farm in Iowa.
So Lark in Bergen County has a question. Hi, Lark.
Hi. My question is regarding, like, CPAP machines and sleep apnea. Probably 6 or 7 years ago, I was diagnosed after my husband heard me snoring considerably louder and louder and then stopping, you know, breathing. So I went and had a test more recently in January, and I actually was notified of your program because my husband texted me and said, you need to put NPR on. This is part of your problem mm-hmm. that's going on. And in January, I started having panic attacks between 3:30 and 4:30 every morning. Just sort of out of the blue, didn't know why it was happening. I've been, you know, blood tested a million times. I'm wondering now, you know, is it something to do with my sleep? Maybe the reactions that I'm having, the feelings that I'm getting are somehow, you know, a change in my sleep pattern, and I haven't picked that up. How often should CPAP machine testing be done? Is there something else I can do beyond that?
Thank you, Lark. And what is sleep apnea, actually, Dr. Bazile?
Sleep apnea is a very important sleep disorder, and it's good that you actually got checked out because lots of people don't. They go on with those same signals for years or even decades. In other words, loud snoring, interrupted sleep, breathing problems in their sleep, and they never get checked out. But not only does it disturb your sleep and make you sleepy the next day, but it's a significant risk factor both for stroke and heart disease. So it's a very important sleep disorder. What happens is, you know, basically as your body relaxes into sleep, which is normal, your throat becomes more and more narrow. And that may just result in snoring because air is being forced through a narrow airway. But if it relaxes more, it actually cuts off your breathing and interrupts your sleep over and over all night. Back to your question, though, what could be the problem? Well, I think you're right. The first question is there something wrong with the machine? Because it could be if at some point in the night you're not getting air, that signal of waking up in a panic happens in people with untreated sleep apnea. So that would be the first thing I would check out, is to make sure that the mask isn't leaking, that there isn't a problem with the machine, and you should talk to the prescriber about that. It's possible that there's something else going on. I mean, you can wake up in a panic from other problems, but that would be the first thing that I would look into.
Lark, good luck. Let's talk more about what happens to our bodies if we don't sleep enough. You pointed us to a study that found you have 3 times the risk of contracting a cold if you sleep fewer than 7 hours a night compared with those who slept at least 8 hours a night. So your entire immune system is compromised with one fewer hour?
Well, that was habitual. And that's another theme in sleep medicine. You know, most people won't have a problem if they're well-rested and then they have one poor night of sleep. But we're talking about chronic sleep deprivation, and that's one of the things that really seems to affect your immune system. And yes, we believe that less than 7 hours isn't enough for most people, and that experiment, that study is one of the lines of evidence. that your immune system doesn't work as well. You don't fight off a cold as well.
When you say 7 hours, do you mean straight, or if you sleep 2 hours here, an hour and a half there, and you wind up with 7 hours, is that the equivalent?
Well, actually, at least from a historical standpoint, it seems to be normal for humans to sleep in two blocks, which I think is kind of fascinating. Hundreds of years ago, when there was no electric lights, people used to go to sleep at sundown. And in most places in the world, except summer, you know, you'd have about 12 hours. Well, you weren't going to sleep for 12 hours. You would sleep for four, then get up, do some things, and then go back to sleep. So that's not necessarily abnormal at all. And we think the total amount is really what's important. The problem is if you get very interrupted sleep, then that can develop into a problem where you have more and more trouble getting back to sleep.
There's another study you pointed us to that suggests that vaccines might not work as well on a person who isn't getting enough sleep. Explain that. It was a hepatitis B vaccine study, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, another very interesting study. What they did is they looked at people who were getting that vaccine, which hopefully everyone is now, and they looked at the antibody titers, which is a measure of how protected they are against that that virus. And what they found is if you were sleeping less, again, I believe it was in the order of less than 7 hours, you had less chance of getting fully protected. Most people who got a full night's sleep over 8 hours, virtually 100% got the correct response, enough to prevent infection. But about 20 or 25% of the people who didn't sleep more than 7 hours a night didn't get protected.
So a weakened immune system is one big health risk correlated to poor sleep. What are some other long-term chronic health issues that are correlated? For example, the links between poor sleep and diabetes, I have read, is real. Obesity, heart disease, cardiovascular issues, mood and mental health issues like depression and anxiety. There's such a list you could find in the literature. I even read that there's some evidence that sleep is correlated to cancer. Is that a real thing?
Well, I was actually going to start with cancer, and I think that relates to the evidence for immune dysfunction, because it may be that your immune system is one of the ways that you prevent against cancer. Those studies, you know, they're harder to do because, you know, finding people sleep habits over a long time and who develops cancer is more difficult than just giving somebody a cold and seeing if they get infected or not. But there are lots of lines of evidence. You mentioned depression and anxiety. There's no question that's involved with sleep and sleep deprivation. And not only involved, it's completely linked. You can't treat depression without treating sleep disorders and vice versa. Heart disease, one of the more important sleep problems related to that I mentioned before is sleep apnea. That's a more concrete one. But if you look at simple sleep deprivation, there are links, but it's not clear how exactly that happens.
We'll continue in a minute with the science of sleep and Dr. Carl Bazile and more of your questions on the science of sleep. It's our family meeting on sleep here on the Brian Lehrer Show today, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And just the beginning of our month-long April sleep project stationwide at WNYC. Go to wnyc.org/sleep for all kinds of sleep stories and information.
Fear of sleep. Fear of sleep. Fear of sleep. Fear of sleep. Fear of sleep.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking about sleep. All show today as part of WNYC's Clock Your Sleep project. Go to WNYC.org to start keeping a sleep journal with many of the rest of us, with the Count Your Sleep app that we'll tell you about in a little more detail in a little while. Right now, we're talking about the science of sleep with Dr. Carl Bazile, Director of the Division of Epilepsy and Sleep at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. And we'll take more of your science of sleep questions in just a minute. That song by The Strokes, Fear of Sleep. Actually, there are people, we had a caller earlier with PTSD, and she was afraid of the nightmares that she would have when she fell asleep. And so that could even be a real thing, fear of sleep, that keeps people from sleeping?
It can be. That's a minority of the sleeping problems that I see. But you know, just imagine if you had been awakened in some sort of a horrible situation, like, you know, bombs going off in a war situation or something like that, you could easily develop an anxiety reaction to going to sleep. But, you know, maybe the corollary for the rest of us is, you know, maybe you're worried about going to sleep because you're afraid you won't wake up in time for that important meeting, or you're afraid you'll forget this, you know, inspiration that you're having just as you're falling asleep. You know, so on a lesser scale, that can contribute to insomnia on a number of levels.
Greg in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Brian. First time caller, long time listener.
Thanks
for having me.
Thanks for joining.
Sure. I have a question about a concept that Buckminster Fuller talked about in the 60s called Dymaxian sleep, where you slept more frequently for less amounts of time. I find when I'm under deadlines, I'm an artist, that I adapt to like a 6-hour sleep cycle in which I have like 2 to 4 hours of sleep, and it's like twice a day. And I'm wondering how that affects our body and our mind, and is that natural in any way for humans to do that, and is in long term, is it healthy?
Well, I probably have somebody at least once a week who says, well, I want to get used to sleeping 6 or 5 hours per night, and I'm sure I can do it, just like, you know, if you exercise, your butt muscles get bigger. Well, it doesn't really seem to work that way.
Right.
There are different sleep schedules that your body can adapt to, however, and it sounds like that's what you're doing. You can get by with, you know, sleeping in different amounts and at different times.
Right.
Some places in the world, you know, they do sleep, you know, maybe 6 hours at night, but then take a 2-hour siesta during the day. And that's perfectly fine for your body as far as anything we can see. You know, what worries me a little bit if you're spending long periods of time getting only 6 hours total. And we think that could end up causing problems.
Greg, thank you. Can you catch up on sleep? People say that all the time, right? This weekend I'm going to catch up on sleep. So if you sleep 5 hours during the week, but 9 or 10 on the weekends, are you good?
That's a really important concept. I kind of mentioned before that most people can get by okay if they're well-rested and then have one short night of sleep. And you will make up for that relatively quickly. What we see from another number of lines of evidence is the sleep loss is cumulative. In other words, you develop something called a sleep debt. So if you start on Sunday night by only getting 5 hours of sleep and you do that all week, by the time you get to Friday night, you're 15 hours behind in what we think is the total sleep requirement. You can make that up, but you probably won't unless you sleep all weekend.
Mike in Pauling, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. And I love your show.
Thank you.
I have a question for your guest. I recently purchased an app for my phone. I won't give you the name of it. I don't want to mark it for them. However,
if you like it, it's very
helpful. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm saying you can Yelp here, meaning if you like it, you can tell us. If you don't like the app, you can tell us that too.
Okay, I love it. I suffer from tinnitus, and that has kept me awake. I usually have chimes hanging around my house, so that kind of breaks up the background noise. Or I go, going to sleep with earbuds in my ear with some music. But this app allows, it's called Brainwave, and it's supposed to induce, for example, it has a dreamy sleep option that allows you to induce a complex sequence of delta and theta frequencies designed to induce sleep combined with vivid dreams. And I'm using this, and it's really improved my sleep dramatically. And you can also have a background noise of ocean waves, and you can adjust the sound that this makes. It kind of gives a humming sound in your ear. Now, it seems to be working for me. Now, my question is...
Now, by now, people really want to know... Have you purchased a placebo? But now, now, people really want to know the name of the app. So what is it?
Oh, didn't I say it? I thought I did. It's called Brainwave.
You did say it. I'm sorry.
It's called Brainwave. And you can grab lucid dreaming, which is really great. I went to a workshop on lucid dreaming many years ago, and my son and I both practiced it until we found that it was keeping us awake.
Mike, hang on a second. If he's purchased a placebo, don't tell him.
Well,
because it'll blow the whole thing.
Well,
that's true.
And placebos do work in sleep, as in a lot of conditions, but I don't think this is really a placebo. What it's doing is it's giving you an external stimulus. In this case, you know, it may be waves, it may be music. I didn't hear all the different things it potentially can do, but that becomes a signal for your brain to shut down. And that's really what a lot of the behavioral treatments for sleep do. Everybody's different. And, you know, there are things, you know, if some people hear crashing waves, that's going to induce anxiety and they won't go to sleep. Many people, it's relaxing. But this is giving you different signals to help you relax, and I think that does work. The brainwave thing, I have to say, I'm a little skeptical about.
Because?
Well, there's no evidence that you can use certain stimuli like that to produce delta sleep, for instance, which is seems like it was trying to tell you. But it can certainly help you get to sleep.
Thank you for your call, Mike. I'm glad there's something that's working for you. So there's the kind of noise that can put you to sleep, and then there's the kind of noise we use to wake ourselves up. Here's the classic alarm clock. So is that the most annoying sound or what? And is there any merit to this idea that instead of setting that annoying sound to wake you up at a specific time, that instead there is a perfect moment to wake up according to your sleep cycles?
Well, a lot of the apps claim to do that, and most of them are associated with motion detectors, accelerometers. So what I think they do is they look for when you're in lighter sleep, which you might be able to do with those sort of devices. I think that's entirely possible, depending on exactly how they work. So then when you wake up, you're not quite as groggy, whereas if it wakes you up during deep sleep, it's harder to get up.
So you give the app, as I understand it, a window of time in which you need to wake up, and it can sense when you're in your lightest level of sleep and wakes you up then, instead of ripping you violently out of a deep sleep, even if that's a half hour, 45 minutes later than the earlier wake-up time might be.
Exactly. And if you want to get more skeptical about it, what it's actually doing is sensing when you're already awake anyway and then making you stay awake.
But is that real science?
Well, I think there's a science to it. That technology has been used in sleep medicine for years. It's called actigraphy, where you use motion as sort of a surrogate for sleep. It's not perfect, but it will give you a pretty good idea of whether you're deeply asleep or not.
For some of the callers we had before you came on, someone talked about natural cycles that tend to boost your awakeness at about 4 a.m. and 11 a.m. Real science?
Yes. That is part of a normal circadian rhythm. And I don't know about those precise times, but I mentioned before that people used to sleep in blocks. There seems to be a natural arousal period mid-sleep, which for most people would be maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, where you tend to wake up. Most people would just go back to sleep. The more obvious phenomenon that most people know about is a time of relative drowsiness, usually just after lunchtime, which is siesta time. It's there because that's part of your natural sleep cycle.
Talk about screens and the effect of that blue light.
Yeah, I think that's a little controversial. I can start with the real science, something that I recommend very frequently, which are the commercial light boxes. Those deliver a strong blue light, which is meant to signal your body it's time to be awake. And, you know, that works through melatonin, basically. Controversy about screens is that they use those same frequencies. So is it possible that that's delivering a stimulus that will interrupt your melatonin and keep you awake at night? Absolutely. I think that for most people, though, especially if you set your screen on the dimmer settings at night, it's probably not going to be a huge problem. The bigger problem is you're staying active on your computer, you're working, you're stimulating your brain in other ways other than light, and that can definitely keep you up.
Tommy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tommy.
Hi, Lou. How are you?
Okay.
I have a question. For the past 10 years, now I have problems sleeping, and I've been taking 250 milligram tablets of the sleep gels, the over-the-counter sleep gels, and 10 milligrams of melatonin and 2 or 3 milligrams of Xanax. And I sleep well. I get up and I go to the gym and I go to work and I do what I have to do. I'm wondering if it has going to have any effect on my liver or kidney or anything else.
Well, it depends on what those are. I can start with the you said you're taking Xanax. You know, what happens with that medicine in particular, medicines like it over time, is you tend to develop tolerance. So it may not really be having much of an effect anymore, although it's part of your signal to sleep. So, and if you stop it, then you may have withdrawal symptoms. So that's a problem that you'd have to work on getting off of. Melatonin, we think, is pretty benign. What was the dose you said you took, or do you know?
Your dose of melatonin, Tommy?
10 milligrams.
10 milligrams. Yeah, that's not a huge dose. It's enough to make people drowsy, and it is a naturally occurring hormone. The gel, I don't know what's in that particular one. Most of them have an antihistamine, diphenhyramine, and that can help to make you drowsy. I don't know exactly what's in the gel that you're taking. They may have a number of things. Most of them are probably going to be benign, though.
Side effects of Ambien, somebody asked earlier, or anything else? Are there long-term reasons not to take substances if they help you sleep?
Well, ideally, I believe that medications, whether they're prescription or herbal or whatever, they're helping to retrain your brain to sleep correctly. So the best way to use something like Ambien is, you know, it may help you in the short term, get you to sleep on a regular basis. You may need to do that for several months, but then you want to try to get off of them. On the other hand, I have people that have been taking these medicines.
But why? Why do you want to try to get off of them? I mean, ideally, it's nice to, you know, not have any external help. But what if it just works and it's hard to get off? Somebody called about dependency as opposed to addiction on a sleep medication. Why do you have to wean yourself?
Well, I was kind of getting to that. If you can't, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world. Ambien is a pretty benign medicine when taken as directed. It doesn't seem to cause dependency, especially in lower doses. And it hasn't been studied for years and years at a time. That's the hesitation. We don't know definitely that there aren't any long-term effects. Although, you know, so many people take that and have been doing it for so long, I think it's unlikely that there are common long-term effects.
Last question. Why do we dream?
Oh, that's the really most unknown area of sleep medicine and perhaps the most interesting. The theories of that is that you're experiencing some sort of shuffling of information during dreams. And you know, when you remember them, most of them seem like nonsense. They may have bits and pieces of what has happened during the day. Some of them have sort of weird plot-like things.
But, or that reflect your hopes or anxieties.
Well, it may. I think there probably is some truth to that. You know, psychiatrists have used dreams for millennia to try to figure out what is going on in people's minds that they're not aware of. So I think there is some truth to the sorting through of things during REM sleep, which is when most of those dreams happen. But exactly what that does in terms of your health, we don't know.
Dr. Carl Bazile, Director of the Division of Epilepsy and Sleep at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. He's been advising WNYC on our new Clock Your Sleep project. Thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Thanks for doing this project. I think it's great.